Great meeting for me. I'm not really a large-scale person. I'm a small-scale structure person. I was dragged into this large-scale structure work, and this meeting has been a great opportunity to try to help me understand what's going on. So I'll try not to take too long, since it's the end of the week, the end of the day. But I'll very quickly go through why you might think of doing surveys for clusters, just using shear as a way of picking out the clusters, and give you a quick overview of how that works technically. So I'll talk about this survey, which is one of a handful of surveys to try to do this over about, the original plan was 30 square degrees. You'll see it's the sample's really down to more like 20 square degrees or less. And of course, all sorts of issues have come up in doing this. I actually got to the point where I sort of came within spinning distance of the cosmological constraints, which is kind of fun given the problems involved. But anyway, the bit I'm really interested in is the last bit, which is the large-scale structure to small-scale structure correspondence. Although I should say as an aside, the other thing I'm interested in knowing is what Mike's plot looks like if he does it in terms of convergence, not radius. Anyway, but I should ask him that question later. So why this bit I think I could probably skip for this audience. Why would you want to measure the properties of galaxy clusters? Well, they could do some constraint on some combination of the amplitude of fluctuations and the equation of state. And if you just have one sample, you measure a point in this space where there's obvious degeneracy, you can shift the fluctuations up and down or change the rate at which they've grown. So as long as you do this at multiple, at different redshifts, you'll start to break the degeneracy a little bit. But in principle, you've got a degeneracy where you can either have bigger amplitude and less growth or less amplitude and less growth. And that, of course, we'll give you a plot in this space that looks a bit like a banana. And when I was first preparing the first version of this talk, I was looking for a nice banana diagram. I couldn't find one, so I just went and got a banana. And I then discovered this actually is a very good description of what the contours look like. They actually, some contours for some experiments look almost exactly like a banana. I found a nice example, too, where they've done the outer contour in yellow and the inner contour in brown, so it's sort of... Anyway, this is more or less the uncertainty you would get from a crude sort of survey that would tell you that sigma 8 somewhere between about 0.8 and 0.6, and omega matters somewhere between 0.2 and you know, sort of 0.3-ish. Maybe it would be a slightly smaller banana on that other axis. There's a nicer, that's a much nicer banana. That's let's say it's from a day or two ago. Just showing you what you can do then if you have a really big sample of clusters. You get these very fun contours. So why bother redoing this with a lensing survey, since there are good constraints from X-ray? So in fact, this is probably one of the only meetings where people will buy, I would say there are strong arguments for doing this, and this is probably the only place anyone buy those. So the first, the usual argument, which I think everyone buys, is that there could be systematics in the baryon, you know, distribution. Whatever baryonic tracers you're using to pick out your X-rays, obviously the easiest way to pick out clusters is in the optical. The second easiest way to pick them out is in the X-ray. Maybe the third is SC. You might worry a little bit that whatever sample of clusters you get once you're trying to constrain things down to a few percent is somehow a little bit biased. So at a minimum, you would want to go back, as a number of speakers have pointed out, you'd want to go back and do lensing after the fact to check that there isn't an obvious bias there. A second, then more subtle point was Fabian's point yesterday that in some alternative models, there might actually be a difference between the lensing mass and the dynamical mass in systems. So you want to measure both separately. And then possibly there might also be differences between the dynamics of the different components within a cluster. So Lam talked about that earlier today. Okay, so there are, in other words, there are theory reasons to do this, even if it doesn't make sense from an error bar point of view. What's much less clear, I think, and especially less clear to me now that I've been through this exercise, is whether selecting clusters by lensing is ever a good idea. It does, at a minimum, provide a sanity check, and I think when the group started this, you know, a long time ago now, there were a lot of these dark objects floating around that were undetected and so on. So there was some concern there might be big, massive structures out in the universe that had no baryonic tracers. And, you know, at a minimum, this is a sanity check to try to catch those unusual objects. Okay. My sense is they all went away, and they all went away partly just because nobody was looking seriously at what the systematics were. And in particular, just projection effects. So, I mean, you know, 5 years of projection effects essentially killed them. I think that's what happened to most of them. Okay, so how do you find clusters from lensing? Well, obviously, you look at an image of a normal patch of the sky like this. You wouldn't necessarily know there's a cluster there. It just looks like a random distribution of galaxies. And then you look and you say, oh, look, there's an arc. There must be a cluster there. That, of course, is strong lensing, but you can imagine doing the same thing with weak lensing. You look at your galaxy field, you measure net alignment of the shapes, and that tells you there's a cluster here, and you can draw contours of convergence around that cluster. To do this is a particularly massive example. To do this in the survey I'll talk about, the peak here is only going to be 4 or 5 sigma, typically, and therefore you want to smooth over the right scale to pick that out. And the right scale, if you work out how the signal goes with radius, the right scale for an NFW profile is around the scale radius of the cluster, which in turn, if you work it out, is varies between about half an arc minute and 2 arc minutes, depending on mass and redshift. So something like taking a map and smoothing it on that scale will actually give you fairly good selection, especially above maybe a redshift of 0.2 or something. Okay. And then the other thing, which his talk group showed the geometry of the lensing a little bit and introduced this factor. I can't remember whether the factor actually showed up there or not, but he showed the geometric plot that gives you this dependence on the signal. So if you think of, if the signal is going as this ratio of angular diameter distances, that means the minimum mass you're sensitive to goes as sort of 1 over that. And what I've done here is just said, suppose I have sources at redshift 1 and a lens at some redshift x, I suppose z might have been a better choice for that, then, except we get into this whole linguistic confusion. What I was talking about. Anyway, so you get a function that looks like this that has poles at 0 and 1, and here's that function plotted. So in other words, you're not at all sensitive to things down here or down here, and then you get contours that sort of are more or less straight lines in this kind of log linear space in between. Okay, so that's your intrinsic sensitivity. Of course, structure is also building up with time. And there's a third effect, which is you're probing more volume. So the grayscale here shows how many sources you expect per square degree per unit redshift, I think. So you expect a lot of sources here, basically, because you've got more volume, but you expect fewer and fewer massive things, and in particular, the most massive things have only built up at low redshift. So what you expect to get in a blind survey is just the intersection of your sensitivity curves, the dashed lines, with the solid curves. And therefore, you hope to find a sample of clusters like this with some very uneven selection, both in mass and in redshift. So in particular, just doing, let's say, a mass-selected subsample of this is a very bad way to analyze what you'll actually get, right? Because you'll get a very different mass threshold at different redshifts.
All off in redshift, low high redshift, in real data compared to the assumption that you have a single source point of origin along with sources of a fixed size.
That's this plot. That's this plot. And the only thing I did do on this plot is show you the figure that would answer that question. So let me go back to this plot.
So, well, I'll go forward first. And the stars have to come back. Okay, so there's this fundamental uncertainty that you're measuring distortions and shapes of, you know, these tiny little things in the background, the image. And I don't think I've ever seen this calculation, but you could, in principle, go and ask how much signal is coming from things in your source catalog as a function of crappiness. And if you plotted signal, or, you know, incremental extra signal versus crappiness, you'd find you're getting more and more signal as you go to crappier and crappier things. So it's always a terrible form of analysis to do, because you want to go and look at the worst possible objects and measure their shapes to get the most signal. And in fact, probably the logical extreme of this is to do something, and my limited understanding is this is how CMB when lensing works, where you don't actually detect any sources at all. You simply do correlations, basically. So you can imagine doing galaxy, you know, doing that with galaxies, right? Using undetected galaxies. So anyway, so you're always going down to a magnitude range where you have no idea what the redshifts are, and you have to look at a particular deep field. So this was good south. This was the photometric redshift distribution they thought they had. And then there's sort of a question of, do you believe this stuff above, you know, redshift 1.5 or 2 or not? I'll show two different analyses in which I either do or don't believe there are things at that redshift. But if I do that, then the main effect it has is these sensitivity contours. If you have the stuff at high redshift, they flatten out and they sort of go like this. So you can then pick up things out here. It doesn't seem to make a big difference down here just because, you know, it's not, the geometry is not great for those high redshift sources being lensed. Okay. Okay. So this survey, this was a survey started at the National Observatory. And a collaboration with a group at Caltech, and then there are a number of people attached to this, sort of listed roughly in order of importance. You can see I'm low down on a late addition to this group and came along sort of once most of the data was there. The motivation for the survey was really this instrument, the PrimeCam, which was a new, at the time, an exciting new wide-angle camera on the Subaru telescope. Subaru telescope, fantastic imaging telescope. SuperOnCam is a fantastic camera with a very large field of view. So lensing is a very obvious thing to do with this. And it was kind of a clever survey strategy. The strategy was simply to take any field Subaru was being asked to image for any other reason with this camera and throw it into the bucket. And this is nice because it gives you a real test of cosmic variance. You get a dozen different fields that are, you know, a reasonable size. They're kind of 1 or 2 degrees each. And they're spread all over the place, including all sorts of ones that you know, you'll recognize deep fields, the cosmos field, and so on. And the other idea with these is by now they all have X-ray data. So eventually, you know, we can start doing a comparison between the things we find. But what's not so great about this is that these were observed, you know, all over the place at many different times in a range of different seeing conditions. And it turns out the way the source catalog was constructed, the number of galaxies varies quite a lot with seeing. So it's varying by sort of a factor of 3 or more. And this is going from when I was doing plots and things, I had 2 bins, I had sort of good and poor seeing. And then the observers explained to me that actually I should really call it good and excellent seeing. So I'll show some results which I think are, you know, the good results versus the excellent results. And it's confusing because the good results are crap and then the excellent results are okay. But it is worth noting that, you know, 0.7 arc second seeing, which is where I cut the sample in 2, is actually good seeing. It's not, you know, it's not, or so I'm told. It's, you know, that's so a lesson from this is going to be, you really, if you're doing this from the ground, you really want to do it in good conditions, or at least have some way of selecting out the best data. Okay, so you do this, you go and measure the shapes of galaxies. From those, you reconstruct what the lens and convergence field is. You make a map, and it looks like this. Here's the sample field, the Lachmann hole. And this, it took me a minute to realize this, but this looks absolutely beautiful in that it doesn't just look like Gaussian noise, right? It doesn't look like Gaussian noise because it looks like a fairly uniform bluish background with then high peaks in it. And you sort of see by eye that the statistics are not Gaussian. There are, the peaks are more peaky than they would be in a random noise field, right? And therefore, these things are sort of real objects. Here is the here's the signal to noise here. So 3 is kind of yellow, 4 is getting on to red, and here are the 4 signal peaks in this field, and these should be real things. You can see, however, that there are also a lot of problems. You have to cut out regions around bright stars, their chip boundaries, and so on. In fact, what you don't see on this, there's a really scary map of what the number counts of source galaxies looks like, and that has all sorts of things in it that aren't real, so or aren't out there in the universe. It's a cutout in the convergence map because, and unfortunately, I think more evidence for this built up as the analysis was being done. The things like the edges of the chip or areas where there's more scattered light, you can't measure the shapes accurately. But that takes a little while to figure out. So it takes a little while to figure out that the shape measurements are systematically worse if you're within some large distance of a bright star, if you're close to the edge where the PSF of the camera is changing, and so on.
Oh, sorry, it's literally been cut out of this image.
You just punched a hole out of this.
This map was made leaving those areas out because there, you know, there's no shapes were measured there, basically. Okay, and there's the peaks.
There's another field. There's another field. Anyway, so you can see there are a bunch of these fields, and they vary in size, and they have some real things in them. You can also see that if you're trying to count peaks, you run into problems. You know, how many peaks are here? Is this one peak? It's close to some areas you cut out. So they're the statistics. I try not to look around too much, basically. Okay, so then the next step was spectroscopic follow-up. Here again, this may not actually be quite the way of doing this with more thought, but anyway, the initial idea was these are massive clusters. We'll go and follow them up spectroscopically. And here is a beautiful example. You do, in this case, multi-object spectroscopy on SuperFOCAS. But there was also a backup, long-term backup program on Keck to get riches just with a long slit spectrograph on some of these. And you see immediately if you plot here, I'm plotting distance inferred from redshift. Sort of, you know, distance, radial distance against distance on the sky, and you see, okay, you've got a massive cluster here at a redshift 0.6. One of the things that helps is there is some crude spectral classification for these galaxies. So the red ones are early type galaxies, and you see not only do you have an excess of galaxies here, but you have in particular an excess of early type. Here's another nice example. Once again, low redshift cluster pops out of this, and then there are a bunch of other things they got spectra for that are just background objects in this case. And with nice, you know, round, massive clusters like this, there's enough signal you can start to fit profiles to them individually. So this is just a convergence profile. This is the integrated mass within that aperture. Okay.
Kind of false positives?
Things yeah, big so I'll show you. So these, of course, these typical ones are, in fact, the best ones, as usual. There's another best one. Okay. So you know, these look really nice. You look at that distribution of redshifts, and you say, okay, clearly we've hit something. And also, the positions of the galaxies of that color are close to the center of the peak, and so on. This is a more representative example. You go and do the follow-up spectroscopy.
First of all, the things you find that might be part of something aren't particularly close to the peak. The peak's close to a fairly bright star. Maybe that's a problem. Looking through this, maybe there's a poor group here, but there's nothing jumps out. And you do expect a lot of cases like that. So this is sort of the punchline. This is everything we found plotted up in mass versus redshift. And what I did here is a little bit sketchy at the bottom. So the top symbols are symbols where you look along the line of sight and you find one object, and therefore it's sensible to assign a mass to it. The fainter points, which I've tried to sort of de-emphasize graphically, are cases where you find a group of galaxies along the line of sight, but you find something else as well, or it's at the wrong redshift to give you much lensing signal, or their projections. So with those, what I did was I just cut up the signal in the peak into two pieces if there were two groups, or three pieces if there were three groups. And therefore, they're very crude mass estimates here. These probably are some of the real structures in that mass range that are just sitting aligned along your line of sight. Okay. So single objects, superpositions, you can compare this then to other methods.
But real clusters or superpositions of stuff, but they're not. Your signal to noise in peaks is good enough.
The pure noise peaks should be negligible. On the other hand, combinations of, say, two 2-sigma peaks making a 4-sigma peak are very common. And most peaks probably have a 0.5 or 1-sigma, projection effect contribution, probably a 0.5-sigma projection effect contribution on top of them, yeah. Okay, so as I went over, there are observational complications in doing this. The seeing varies from field to field and within fields. There are other noise variations across each field. The source galaxies you're looking at themselves are clustered spatially, for instance, so you naturally have different sensitivity across the field. Some regions in the sky will just happen to be easier regions to do lensing than others, for reasons that have nothing to do with the lensing stuff you're looking at. There are obviously cosmetic problems, and there's this uncertainty in photometric redshifts. And then also in analyzing the data, there's the question of, did you get a redshift for the cluster? And that, of course, can fail for different reasons. If you have very nearby stuff, you may target the wrong galaxies. If you have very distant stuff, you may just not get a good enough spectrum to measure a redshift. Okay. There are also, though, some physical complications, and this is sort of where the projection effects come in. And this is part of this literature of the dark objects disappearing over the course of 5 or 10 years. As more and more ways were thought of to get rid of them. There are only about 4 or 5 ways in which you pick up extra mass in a system. First of all, the clusters themselves are not spherical and have substructure, but they also then, of course, have correlated mass around them. And while you can correct for that, for instance, in something like a halo model, you can imagine splitting into one halo and two halo terms, there will be much more, the shape of the mass around the cluster will be much more irregular, and therefore there'll be a big noise contribution from the fact that the stuff outside the virial radius of the cluster, say, is going to be less spherically distributed. Okay. So this, depending on how you do the analysis, this term, the correlated mass, gives you, can give you a 20% bias if you do the calculation naively, but also there's then the kind of correlation, the kind of projection effect you can think of, which is just something totally unrelated that happens to be along your line of sight, a group or something. And then finally, there's a contribution from large-scale structure, which is also going to affect things. So those are physical problems. Another thing I'll talk about a little bit later on is is the idea of dilution, which is sort of a is kind of a physical problem with the measurement. Basically, you're measuring the wrong thing. Okay. So given these problems, then I tried some sanity tests on this sample of clusters. One was just to see if the optical richness of the cluster makes sense given the inferred lensing mass and redshift. And it turns out to do that, you have to make such a big correction, given our magnitude limit, for how many galaxies you'd expect in the cluster, that you're totally dominated by the correction. So if you don't make the correction, it's hard to say, you know, what you see. You maybe see a slight increase in richness with redshift and mass, which is what you'd expect. If you make the correction, you get nice correlations. On the other hand, most of the power of that is in the correction. So this is really just a sanity check. If you found things at low redshift that would have to be incredibly rich clusters, or found things at low masses that turned out to be incredibly rich, then it would suggest you're getting either the masses or the redshifts wrong. What I am doing is basically taking a fit to the cluster luminosity function, redshifting that, applying our magnitude cut, and comparing it to a count of bright galaxies in the region of that cluster. So it's a very crude thing. Yeah.
So actually, there's a K correction and there's evolution, and
the way I was doing it, they roughly cancel out. They're both kind of 0.1 magnitude-ish corrections. It was messy enough that I didn't bother. Another way to think about this plot would just be to remove it entirely from the proceedings. It's just I think this is just a sanity check. As I say, if you did this exercise and found, well, you know, if you think this cluster is really at redshift 0.2, then it has to be, you know, incredibly rich, and why don't you see those galaxies or something? This would be a way of catching kind of obvious mistakes in redshift design or something. This is maybe more robust. So this is the redshift distribution of the objects we found. The redshifts themselves have varying degrees of certainty. So the green is using all the redshifts we have. The red is sort of ones where we're really sure from multi-object spectroscopy what redshift they're at, and that we do have a single cluster along line of sight. And those, if you compare them to the predictions for either high or low redshift distributions, the match is pretty good, at least if you do cuts at kind of 4 sigma in the catalog. Now, there's a slight effect, which is a little hard to see because the statistics drop off, but as you go to higher peaks, you're kind of losing peaks, which is strange.
Of the lensing signal is mass, because it depends on what you were assuming for the source redshift distribution. So I assume you know that.
That's putting that aside, yeah. I mean, you know, this here gives you just an estimate of what the, you know, what the
other curves numbers that you've drawn.
Yeah.
The dash curves.
The dash curves. The dash curves are how many halos there are in particular mass ranges that you could see. So they give you, I should have labeled these. They give you, I think this runs from 5 times 10 to the 14 and 10 to the 14. Other way around. 5 times 10 to the
10 to the 13, 5 times 10 to the 13, 10 to the 14, 5 times 10 to the 14. So what it tells you is down here, you know, you're probing kind of groups. Up here, you're only really picking up, you know, fairly massive clusters, 5 times 10 to the 14 or more. But in a sense, they're unrelated to whether the color histograms match the solid curve. Okay, but there was this thing. I didn't find as many high peaks as expected. Tried playing around with this a little bit. The number of peaks over the whole survey is this black curve here, and it drops off quite steeply with peak height. And if you just go and do a sort of prediction from Preshector and so on, you get, depending on whether you use the high or low redshift distribution for the source galaxies, you get one of these lower two colored curves, And then as you add noise to that, you push the numbers up because you have a steeply dropping number of peaks, and therefore if you add noise to them, you get more high peaks, basically, rather than fewer. So this was very dissatisfying. It was very dissatisfying to find that, you know, there were fewer high peaks than expected. It's hard to understand how you could lose high peaks by, as I say, by adding noise. And the clue to this came from splitting the sample by, mainly by seeing. So if you split it into just two halves, according to the data taken better or worse seeing, you find there's actually quite a dramatic difference. There are basically no high peaks found in the maps, you know, of regions observed in poor seeing. Whereas there are a whole bunch of them than if you observe good seeing. So I had no idea why that was, and I think, one issue was, is this cosmic variance? These are different fields. Maybe the fields are intrinsically different. So I tried plotting mass functions of numbers of peaks for all the fields, and I found all the fields taken in good seeing, which are the red curves here, and all the fields taken in poor seeing, they all split into kind of two groups this way. So I'll tell you the punchline here. This was something that I think we should have maybe thought of earlier. So how can you lose signal behind high peaks? Well, high peaks arise every time you get a galaxy cluster. A galaxy cluster has a lot of faint galaxies in it. If those faint galaxies bleed into your source catalog, every time you have one of those things, it's not lensed, and therefore it dilutes your signal. And it doesn't have to dilute the signal by a lot to completely knock out the high peaks. So for instance, if you have 20% of the source galaxies actually being cluster galaxies, then your five sigma peaks all drop down. So this has been studied subsequently, in more detail in multi-band surveys. And this now, obviously, I think is the way to do this. You use at least, say, two different filters and try to bracket the red sequence in the cluster and remove that stuff from your data. And one way of doing this without knowing the redshift of the cluster in advance is just to see how the profiles change as you move around color cuts in your source sample. So this, unfortunately, was not available for this survey because we don't have colors for all the fields.
The different thing?
Yes. Another way of doing it would just
be to go and use many of these fields do actually have colors. And
So the bit of this I didn't figure out was why would seeing make such a huge difference? And that, I think I've only recently, I suspect I know why this is, but I haven't really confirmed this with, the part of the team that did the original catalogs. I think it's that there was a cut in the source catalog based on the size of point sources. And that just moves you around, so you get into a range where you're cutting out a lot of the galaxies, and the relative fraction the cluster contributes is much higher.
You might have a number of exposures for some of the clusters, so you could just split them into two.
Yeah, and I'd also like to, this must be a really strong trend, because in fact the seeing varies pointing by pointing, and I haven't even been the data pointing by pointing. I've just been to field by field. So pointing by pointing, I think you get an even stronger effect. So this is something which I think, you know, going back, we can try to maybe fix.
So for the if you want to understand the effect of seeing, presumably you can take 0.6 arc second seeing and just in software turn it into 0.8 arc second seeing.
Yeah, and recut the catalogs. And I think it's very straightforward what happens. I think what happens is you have if you have log size versus magnitude. Stars have this sequence where here they're kind of saturated, And then here they're just, or sort of, no, here they're not saturated. They're, here they're, it's, yeah, they are saturated. So the images look bigger. Here you have what point sources should look like in your data, and the galaxies are kind of doing this. And the cuts were made based on the size of point sources. So there were cuts designed to reject hit stars. And it, I think as you move that cut up and down, you then just change the relative contribution of these things to the cluster galaxies. So, yeah, so I think it's that this is when you, you know, theory at least, is this is where all this stuff comes from. So if you just look at the good scene data, already it's now looking much closer to the models for the number of peaks you expect. And if you further do a cut in redshift to throw out the high redshift and low redshift regions where it really didn't look like we were getting many peaks, then you get the red curve, which I would argue is a beautiful match to the theoretical predictions, which are these black curves. And this is one where there's no intrinsic scatter in the signal halo of a given mass, a given redshift produces. And then these are ones where you add a little bit of scatter, as you might expect from the fact the halos are not spherical, they have substructure and so on. And what you can see is that, you know, with a little bit of scatter, maybe the red curve, you know, sits right on top of these theoretical models, where if you just looked at the counts for the whole survey, they just don't make sense. There's a big deficit of high peaks. Yeah, I normalized this, and that gives you a measure of sigma 8. And I didn't bother doing nice-looking bananas because it's not a very good measurement. It's about a 10% measurement based on 7 clusters. So then I was thinking, oh, well, we've got 10 times that many. We can do, you know, we can get at least a 3% measurement or something like that. But then I realized, well, no, actually, it's only, I think only a third of the error bars on this are shot noise. Their contributions in matching the red, the observed mass function or peak function to the theory, their contributions from just how many clusters you have, but also you don't know, I did a redshift cut here, and you don't know with the things you don't have redshifts for, you don't know whether they're in that bin or not. So redshift completeness is another probably third of the errors in this. And then obviously there are a lot of systematic uncertainties about where I put the cut exactly, or, you know, so my guess is, you know, a third of this you could get rid of. Anyway, it's kind of neat that you can get reasonable constraints basically from lensing only, just picking lensing peaks with no knowledge about gas or anything. Okay. Okay. Sorry, I should really finish up here. I will try to zoom through this. I also sort of wondered, given this is not obviously a great way of measuring sigma 8, are there other things you can do with halos you detect this way? I'd argue there is one other in a, you know, you take all the information you have about halos in a simulation and put it in a file and gzip that file. How big is the file? That for halos, that file is about, you know, 3 floats or double. That is, there are 3 things about a dark matter halo that are important. Its mass and redshift, let's say, but also some third thing. And that third thing is its concentration, or its shape, or its age, or its substructure, that all these things roughly track one another. So in particular, the
shape.
Why would concentration track shape? So I would argue that it does that statistically. That statistically you can get a range of shapes and concentrations, but that those two things are correlated, and that there's a lot of power in the correlation and not much power outside the correlation.
So you think I can extract 3 numbers from any mesh cluster?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
This is given your data. With better data, probably more.
I mean, I think all I'm saying is if I ran a halo finder rather than just listing mass and redshift, mm-hmm. then there'd be a third thing to list, and that thing would contain a lot of information. And this is actually not my hypothesis. I mean, this is based on a lot of papers. So there are a lot of papers linking the formation history of halos to concentration in particular. The connections with shape and spin are then, I think there is then more scatter there.
Okay.
But the basic idea is this, that if a halo is old, it's concentrated.
If it's young, it's less concentrated, and you can understand that physically in terms of the density of the material that goes into it or the extent to which it's spread out as it forms. So how could you use this information? Well, schematically, you could take your banana where you don't know where you are on the banana, just counting objects, and you could say, well, there's a difference between models like this where I had a large amplitude of fluctuations and models like this where I had less of one, which is that the clusters here formed more recently, and therefore they should be less concentrated. Well, it's kind of.
I think you're right. I mean, maybe it should be. Yeah. Okay. I mean, this is definitely right. Right. It's green, so it's not ripe yet.
So that's good. Yes. But this banana is, yes, is a statistical banana, right? It has nothing to do.
It can be.
I mean, it's banana in the sense that this is what the shape of likelihood is due to degeneracies in your trying to recover. Well, so
sorry, you're right.
You're right.
What I should say is, if I found 100 clusters using some selection, any observational selection.
If I found 100 clusters, it would put me on some banana, right? Okay. If I then knew whether those were old or young clusters, it would tell me where I am in this banana. Okay. That's. Yeah. This is the statement. Another way of doing it would be if you changed your selection to bias you towards younger or lower clusters, you would move around, and you wouldn't get a banana, you'd get half a banana. Okay, so this is just a sort of toy model of this, which unfortunately is almost invisible, modeling how concentration forms based on mass accretion histories, sort of fresh ejector merger trees, and it's using relationships between mass accretion and concentration that are calibrated off simulations. And basically, this is the old bit of the banana, and the green distribution is the young bit of the banana. And there's not a huge difference, obviously, but you get an excess of concentrated things if you're up here. So another way of putting that would be if you split your sample into, the 100 clusters you find and the 20 most massive, that might break the degeneracy along the band a little bit. Can we do this in practice with this data set? Well, probably not. This is one of our best measured mass profiles for this object, and you can see the effect here of varying concentration from quite low to quite high is just around the scale of the error bars. But obviously, there are more massive clusters out there you can do this with, and other ways of proceeding. Right. Okay. So let me just talk very, very quickly about one last way of measuring this, which is to ask how lumpy is each halo. There again, young things should be lumpy, old things should have digested all their lumps. This is based on the LOCUS survey, a different lensing survey, that looked at the brightest X-ray clusters in a redshift range, picked basically to optimize their lensing signal, and then tried to reconstruct the potential around each one from a combination of weak lensing in the outer parts, strong lensing to get multiple components on sort of group scales, and then galaxy-galaxy lensing to figure out the contribution from individual galaxies. If you look at a set of objects like this and just crudely break them up into the orange things that have a single relaxed potential, the green things where there are bigger deviations, and then the blue things where there are multiple lumps within the same cluster. These, I should say, are all just the cores of each of these clusters, so they're, this is unlikely to be projection and stuff. You find there's a relationship, if you then compare that to models of cluster formation, there's a relationship between the amount of substructure you see and the time, for instance, some characteristic time measured from the mass accretion history. Basically, things that built up 90% of their mass recently have a lot of undigested substructure. That was a very preliminary measurement with the first 10 of these clusters, and the interesting thing about it is that the observations here, the black histogram, doesn't look at all, even with the shot noise of only having 10 objects, doesn't look particularly like the models for what the substructure fraction should be. It looks like this sample was picking out, you know, sort of reasonably average clusters, but then very relaxed clusters. It looks like there's a slight excess in this of very relaxed clusters with very smooth potentials. So that's a sort of hint at some very low significance that things that are X-ray bright, you know, might be particularly relaxed. I will leave you with a couple of conclusions. Lensing surveys, I've discovered, are hard work. I'll probably go do something else. It's interesting that these surveys always wind up detecting 4-5 sigma objects because, well, if you had more signal, you would just go further down the catalog, and that from the sound of it, is very much the problem that is starting to come up in other fields, like I said, that you have 4-5 sigma detections above statistical noise, but then with 1 sigma systematics. It looks with lensing like you might need a survey 4-5 times the area of this one, but also with at least 2 filters to get a nicer version of these constraints. Of course, by the time you've done that, there are other things you can do, like shear. Spectroscopic follow-up. I went to a very nice talk on plans to do this for SPT clusters using basically photometric redshifts of the red sequence. So that might be a good way if you did get, here we got 80, 90 clusters, if you got, you know, 1,000. And finally, I think there's some information in this, the structure within the halos that's really good.
Questions?
So for your F-sum statistically disclosing, how was that measured exactly? What does that mean?
Yeah, so that was a little bit complicated. If you take essentially the projected mass within some small aperture, which was 350 kpc or something, so I think it works out to quite a high overdensity within these clusters. So if you just look at the core, and you have this mass model to fit the lensing, and you ask how much of the mass is in the smooth component, and how much is in the other components, and these are all elliptical components, so you sort of ask, how big are the fluctuations in mass terms relative to the smooth component? And then I was doing a pretty naive correspondence between that and my models, where I literally know how much mass is bound to substructure. So I think the main content of that measurement is really in these systems up here, these things where 20, 30, 40% of the mass is in some secondary component. So those are systems where, looking at the center of the cluster, you have 2 distinct peaks that are clearly real, and you have that normally because you have a strong lens image between them. Step on this again. So that's what happens down at the lower bit of this is much less clear because that's based on the sign of mass of the galaxies and so on. And you probably miss groups, gets stuck, it's modeled.
Can you change detection efficiency because of clustering of background galaxies? Suppose your cluster looks at the clump of background galaxies. Mm-hmm. Can you enhance detectability?
So I was worried about that, and also about that I put into. And just go back to the noise predictions. I put that in. That essentially convolves your average noise in the survey with some distribution. And that is the difference between, I think, this dashed curve and the highest curve. So these curves are sort of based on no noise, then the mean, no extra scatter from noise, the mean noise for the whole survey, the noise for the good bit of the survey, and what happens if you convolve the noise distribution from the fact it seems to vary. The nice thing is we have a measurement of that, actually, because the noise is measured by randomizing galaxy positions.
So I don't have the plot of this, but you can compare how those compare to the number you expect just from the intrinsic shape of galaxies. And it does look like there's a little more scatter in the noise than you'd get just from, say, you know, shot noise. It's also an issue with seeing presumably means you're selecting galaxies with a different redshift distribution as a function of seeing. And that I haven't really included in any of this. So that would be a fundamental uncertainty, I think, if you did a larger, you know, better version of this.
Mike, do you know if this would be an issue for computing the strong lensing? How do you do this? Again, if you have the angular correlation function for the galaxies, right, to create, then our second, I guess, typical correlation lines of time. So if you project it on your cluster.
It shouldn't change the mean number, should it? Because the number.
Yeah, but it's
the
like,
number density is the
but
same.
But it's like the scatter in the. I mean, it's like when you measure masses of clusters, if you have a scatter towards higher. You know.
But if the strong lenses are mainly just when you see one, if it's just one galaxy, you're no more likely to get. You know, that's just set by the however many objects there are in that part of the source plane that's being magnified. So what are the chances of getting one? Well, so even if they all come in pairs, so that would actually dilute it, I think, right?
Well, I would say
if all galaxies came in pairs, for instance, that would actually drop the density of strong lenses by a factor of two. They came in close pairs. If whenever one was lensed, another one was lensed, that would actually drop the density.
No, it depends on the probability per cluster, right?
They were next to each other, like, you know,
depends on the probability per cluster, right? If you have a cluster which is sufficiently massive and you expect that it always makes a lens, then clustering could dilute. If, you know, the probability for a cluster of 10 to the 15 to have strong lens is like 1 in 10, then you can increase it if you have more, you know, lines of sight with the stable cluster. Yes.
I don't think anybody's considered this. One thing you could do is you could look at the noise you get from randomizing galaxy positions. And look at so that should give you, that should go down as you have more and more galaxies, obviously. So if you divide out the effect that it depends on the number density of galaxies, then fluctuations around that can come from two things. First of all, just kind of, I guess, a sort of shot noise term in where the galaxies are behind your object, and also clustering. And because the number of galaxies here is an average for the whole field, so it'll vary. So that's what I was calculating here. I was calculating the intrinsic scatter, which corresponds basically to the intrinsic shape of the source galaxies. So it's about 0.4 on average. That is to say the galaxies have an axis ratio of about 2 to 1, or 2.5 to 1. But then there is this scatter, and I think the dashed lines here make the red. It's maybe the red lines are what you would get from shot noise alone. So it looks like there's a little more scatter outside that, which I think in effect is measuring source clustering. Although it may also be measuring systematic variations in, you know, cosmetics, the PSF, various other things that would vary spatially across the world.
Okay, well, let's thank James again.